this afternoon. I wanted to see Monica unwrap the sauces she'd ordered. Chapter 22. Abram and I stopped at Marshall's for a meal and a chat with laborers at the bottom echelon of the palace. I had a pasty and wine watered at my request. Abram drank his wine straight and had a second glass besides. I'd have needed help getting up the stairs if I'd done that. The wine Marshall served us was quite strong. I don't know what the rest of his customers ate, but there was meat in my pasty. I'm pretty sure the other diners got a filling of lentils and rice, which, with the sauce it was cooked with, would have been very good. Two of those eating turned out to be the gardeners who'd helped plant the new lemon tree. I treated them to an extra glass each and said, "Do you fellows have to tend the tree now that it's in the ground?" "No," said Omar, the senior man. "The girls are doing that, Setney says." The other man, Carlo, said, "Setney's our foreman, which means he sits on his butt in the shade and watches us work." Omar said, "Well, I guess they can pour a bucket of water on it every day, and when it sets fruit, they can pick it." We chatted a little longer, then went upstairs. Abram hadn't said anything during the meal, but his very silence showed that he was worried. Normally, after a couple glasses of wine, he'd be chattering like a magpie. When I got to the console, the first thing I did was enter the day's invoices. They included the order from Roussel, who specialized in exotic items. These generally had to be ordered and bought from off-planet and imported through Esky Marrakesh, which added several levels of delay and expense to the process. I noticed a repeated order for Saguntine pepper sauce for the wives' wing. The only person from Saguntum in that wing was Monica Smith. Supposedly, Saguntum was covered by treaty with Ben Yusuf, so there shouldn't have been any Saguntines in the palace except by their own will. Monica was certainly not here by her own will. I checked the camera in her room. She wasn't present, but in the corner of her bed was the box which had contained the sauces. It sat upended to display the bottom. On the fiber board was printed the word "yes" in large black letters. As best as I could tell on the screen, she'd written with coal eyeliner and a brush. I switched to one of the pair of cameras on the wives' garden. Three of the wives sat on the shaded side. A pair of female servants served them cool drinks, and a eunuch waved a feather fan without enthusiasm in front of Derica, a local wife but very delicate in her tastes. Monica sat against the opposite wall reading. She was back deep into the plantings there, though they included hollies with prickly leaves. The foliage protected all but her lower legs from the sun. She was wearing loose trousers and slippers with long stockings. Her head was within 6 inches of the door to the tunnel by which the tree had been brought in. I took a deep breath. This might work or it might not, but it was as good a time as any. I unlocked the electronic bolts, then got up and said to Abram, "You might want to stay here. Or go someplace else with lots of witnesses." "I'll come along," he said with a sour expression. "For a smart man, Roy, you act like a bloody fool sometimes." I didn't argue with him. I took the pry bar, which I didn't expect to need, and a screwdriver, which I did. I don't know what Abram had besides the knife, but he laid that open in his lap as he squatted beside the alley door. "I'll tap when I'm ready to come out," I said with my hand on the strap handle. "If somebody's in the alley, you ring something metal on the panel and I wait."
"What if it's the Admiral's soldiers and they want in?"
Abram said. I don't think he was really worried about that, but he was in a sour mood and determined to put a dark wash on everything. "Let them try," I said, shrugging. "There's a sliding bolt on my side." Of course, in that case, I'd have to leave through the wives' wing. I just might be able to make it alive, but I had no way of getting out of Salaam, let alone off-planet. There was no one in the alley. I pulled the door open with my left hand. It was a strain, but the penetrating oil had worked. The bar was in my right hand, but that was partly in case somebody was waiting in the passage, which of course there wasn't. I closed the massive panel behind me, and because Abram had made a point about it, I shot the sliding bolt. The passage was unlighted. I hadn't brought a light with me because the passage was straight and the walls were smooth. I shuffled ahead with my left fingertips on the wall, and the bar outstretched in front of me like a steel cane. It touched the interior door with a faint chink. I set the bar down and felt for the view panel, suddenly wishing I'd brought a light after all. There was a slot-head screw in each corner of the cover plate. I'd lubed each of them on my first visit to the passage, but I hadn't come back to open them. I fitted the screwdriver, gripped the handle with both hands, and leaned against the butt to keep it in contact. To my great relief, the first three cracked free when I turned them out. When I started to turn the last one, the plate itself swung down as the screw head loosened. The screech of rusted metal probably wasn't loud anywhere but in the sealed passage, but despite my startlement, I was also relieved that I'd been able to open the thing. I hadn't really been sure until it happened.
"Are you there?" a girl asked from the other side of the heavy screen. "Can you get me out of here? I can pay well."
"I'm here," I said, looking out at the back of a blonde head. "Getting you out is going to take a while. I plan to do it."
"Can you watch for anyone coming up behind me?" the woman said.
She got up and turned her wicker chair around, then sat down again facing where I stood. Her lips were farther away, but I could see them, which really would help me understand her words.
"Who are you?" Monica said. "And how were you able to send me a message in the package of hot sauce?"
"Look, I'm a friend," I said, "and I want to get you out of here, but it takes planning." I was afraid to tell her my name. I didn't know whether she was the sort to blurt things to friends or scream threats to an enemy. And anyway, it wouldn't help her to know. From what I'd seen from the cameras, Monica was about as solid as I could wish for. I was still afraid. The note was simple enough. I had gone to Roussel with the latest specialty order and told him to place it under the four bottles of Saguntine pepper sauce. If he did so without opening it, there would be 100 piastres cash as soon as I was sure. The note said, "If you want to get out, write yes on a card and place it where the camera in your room can see it. Then sit in the garden near the door through which the lemon tree came in. It may take some days for me to respond. If this note has been opened, write no. I'll find another way."
"All right," said Monica. She swallowed. "How can I help?"
I could see to the cross wall past her blonde head, but the opening was fairly narrow. It was possible that someone could approach from the side without me seeing them. That would require walking in the direct sun, but I still worried. Monica may have thought the same thing. She grinned and raised her open book slightly.
"I've begun mumbling the words when I read," she said. "It won't surprise anyone. Only three of the other wives can read at all."
"Getting us off planet is going to be very hard," I said. "You're a Saguntine citizen, though, so you're covered by treaty. I could get you to the Karst Consul, and he could get you back to Saguntum."
"No," Monica said, loud enough that she startled herself.
She turned her head to see if anybody else had heard her. Apparently not, because she faced me again and said,
"He already knows I'm here. He won't help. He doesn't dare help."
"All right," I said. That wasn't what I'd wanted to hear, but I'd have to take her word for it. "I'll work something else out."
"Mark is coming over with a glass of sherbet," Monica said, her voice dropping to a hiss. "When can we talk again?"
"Keep coming here," I said. "I don't know how long it'll take." I swung the plate up over the screen. I fitted in a second screw with my fingers because I didn't want to touch metal to metal while a eunuch might be right outside. Back to square one. Well, I'd get there. We'd get there. On the way around toward the palace entrance, I said to Abram, "Do you know anything about the Karst Consul?"
"Plath?"
he snorted. "Nothing that makes me want to know him better.
What are you after?"
"Anything you can get," I said. "Everything." Despite Monica's violent response, it seemed to me that Plath was the best place to start. All I could find on the console about him was his rank, where he lived, and how many soldiers, six, were assigned for his protection. Foreigners generally had official guards with them when they went out. Most of Salaam was what would be called a slum on any civilized world, and the locals were likely to blame foreigners rather than accept the responsibility themselves. I'd been told there'd been riots in the past, but all that I'd heard of during my weeks on Ben Yusuf were cases of stone throwing directed at merchants from off-planet. I wore the feathered red cap of the palace, and mostly I was with Abram. I hadn't had any trouble. I'd switched to going over the food deliveries, figuring my portion. It was about time for me to canvass the suppliers to pick up the cash I was owed. As a result, I'd forgotten about Plath when Abram reappeared at my side.
"Want to meet a couple guys?"
he said when I'd paused and looked at him.
"Sure," I said. "Where and when?"
"Right now," Abram said. "And down to Etzel's, if that's all right."
"Sure," I said, rising from the console.
This might cost something, you know," Abram added with a frown.
"That's all right, too," I said as we headed for the stairs.
I was carrying several thousand piastres in my money belt,
Ben Youssef didn't have scrip or a real credit banking system, but I was going to have to find something to do with my earnings pretty soon, or I'd weigh too much to move around. Abram would probably have a suggestion. I just started my graft to give me pocket money, but it had taken off almost by itself. I wondered what my dad would have thought. What I thought was that I ought to be ashamed of myself. I was stealing candy from babies, it was so easy. But I had to have money to get off planet, and this was the only way a slave could get it. The cafe was more crowded than it had been the first time I'd visited, but Etzel had moved other tables to a distance from the one the boy led us to. One of the two men already sitting there looked enough like Abram that they could have been related. The other was a foreigner, whom I recalled sitting beside Platt during the slave auction. They already had wine in front of them. I waited till the boy served me and Abram, then said, "I'm hoping you gentlemen can give me information about Consul Platt, can you?"
"I guess we can," said the local. "Whether we will or not, that's something else."
"Yeah," said the other man. "We work for the Karst Consul, so the Admiral doesn't have any authority over us." "You'd be compensated for anything you told me," I said, giving them a friendly smile. "And so long as you never leave the consulate, you're absolutely correct about the Admiral's authority." I paused and added, "His legal authority." "Look, what is it you want to know?" the local said. I shrugged. "Start with the house," I said. "How's it arranged?" I didn't see how that could help me, but it was all grist for the mill. Besides, it got them talking and allowed me to pay them for something that looked harmless. That would lubricate the process. "Well, it's split in half," the local said. "Half is consulate, but the other half's where Platt lives with his family. They got a separate entrance." "Family," I said. I hadn't thought of that. "Wife and three kids," the local said. "She's from Kars too, and a nastier bitch I don't want to meet." "He deserves her," said the other man. "He figures he can treat me any bloody way he pleases, because I can't get off planet without him." "I suppose that'd take a lot of money," I said. "Too bloody right," he said. "Over 1,000 pi, to get to Eski Marrakesh and buy a passage on a freighter there." "Platt has a local squeeze on the official side," the local said. "He changes her every 6 months or so." "Suppose the wife knows?" I said. "Servants talk, I mean."
"Hell yes, they talk," the other man said. "Besides, she's having it off with the chauffeur, so it's not like she's got a complaint."
I put 100 piastre coin in the middle of the table, then thought for a moment and slid it in front of the local man and brought a similar coin out. That one I put in front of the other man. "Go on," I said. "They're yours." Their hands swept up the coins like lizards snapping flies. They looked at me. The local said, "That's all you want to know?" "No," I said, smiling again. "I believe that the consulate has a master computer, is that so?" The local said, "Yeah. Abram said you'd probably want to know about that. That's why I brought Ajax here." The other man swallowed. "I run the console," he said. "Can you give me electronic access to it?" I said. "Passwords, encryption, whatever I need to make full use of it." The two men looked at one another. "For how much?" the local said. "500 to Ajax right here," I said. "After I've entered successfully, another 1,500 piastres to Ajax and," I grinned at the local, "1,000 for you as a finder's fee."
"Bloody hell," Ajax murmured.
"He's a genius with the console,"
Abram said, sounding like he meant it. If I'd really been a computer genius, I wouldn't need the information I was buying. On the other hand, I had a good idea of what money could buy and how to buy those things. "How quickly can you get me the information?" I asked, taking coins out of my belt. I had them in pockets of 500 piastres each.
"How quick can you pay us?" the local said.
"I'll give you both your money," I said, "as soon as I've entered Platt's computer successfully." I set the stack of 500 piastre coins in front of Ajax, but I kept my finger on top of it. "So," I said, meeting his eyes, "do we have a deal?" Ajax licked his lips and said, "Yeah, we got a deal. I'll go back and get the codes. I can't do it off the top of my head. And look, I can't get you into the consulate anyway." "No problem," I said, taking my finger off the coins and making a brushing motion with my hand toward Ajax. "You can give the information to Abram to bring back to me. I'll give him the money for you as soon as it's worked."
"I don't want him to have our money," the local man said.
I shrugged. "All right, I'll come down and pay you myself in the alley behind the palace," I said. "Or you can come up to the Chamberlain suite if you like. Abram can get you in, I'm sure." I crooked an eyebrow. Abram nodded solemnly. Ajax swallowed. "Okay," he said, sweeping up the money. Abram can come with me now. I'll write the codes down and come back with him. I'll wait in the alley while he runs it up to you.
We'll wait in the alley, the local man said. And don't screw around. Come right back with the money.
Or what, I thought. But I had no intention of stiffing them. As soon as the codes work, I said, nodding. I went back to the palace and got to work. I liked to be seen at the console when Georgios made one of his occasional passes through, though after my first few days on the job, he'd never spoken to me about what I was doing. Orders were entered, directed to the proper vendors, marked as delivered, and paid as quickly as an invoice could work its way through the chancellor's office, which wasn't very quickly, but that was outside my department. It seemed that so long as the job was getting done, the chamberlain didn't care how that was happening. I'd been cheerful the few times he came by, but I wasn't exactly welcoming. He was free to do anything he could on the console, but that was bloody little, and I didn't set out to train him to do additional things. I was lost in maintenance accounts when Abram reappeared. He got my attention by stepping so close that he was almost leaning into the projected image. I raised a finger for attention, shut down what I was doing, and said, "What do you have?" He handed me a piece of paper, the inside of a wrapper from a container of toiletries from Karst.
"They're in a hurry," he said.
"They'll wait," I said, as I began the process of connecting with a computer in the Karst consulate. Salam didn't really have an internet, but there were wired connections from the four off-planet consulates to the palace, as well as a connection between the palace and the Admiralty, which was the headquarters of the war leader who would command the community's ships in event of open warfare. That would only come about if another planet attacked Ben Yusuf, which hadn't happened in living memory. It was less expensive to make treaties with the pirate cities and pay tribute. It was called indemnities, for the privilege of placing consuls to safeguard captured citizens. I had my own opinion of that, but it was a political question, and the old Fetcheries weren't politicians. I joined, tried to join the RCN, though, which I guess was my answer to the question. I reached the Karst computer, which I hadn't been sure of doing, and keyed in the initial password, Demetrian. The site responded, albeit slowly. "I wonder why Demetrian," I muttered, mostly to myself. Abram was standing close. He said,
"That's Ajax's name. His last name. Why?"
I looked at him. "It's the password," I said. "Can you read, Abram?"
"Nah, it didn't seem worth the effort," he said.
He tried not to sound offensive, but he turned his face away as he spoke. "It's the main password for the computer," I said. "I don't think being able to read gains anybody much on Ben Yusuf, no. If I were going to stay, I'd see to it that somebody taught Abram to read." I looked at the computer directory, then opened the subdirectory marked Consulate. It required the second of three numerical passwords, which Ajax had written under Demetrian. It was an inventory of consulate equipment. It included a ship, the Alfraz. I got up. "Let's go give our friends their pay, Abram," I said. "They've earned it." Chapter 23. My money belt was a lot lighter as Ajax and his buddy walked out of the alley, but that didn't matter. I had no use for Ben Yusuf money except to get off Ben Yusuf, and I still had this week's round of suppliers to make. We were alone in the alley, so it was a good place to walk. "Abram," I said, "there's a ship in the harbor named the Alfraz. I want to know what its status is, what crew, everything you can about it."
"I don't know nothing about ships," Abram said, frowning.
I grimaced, but it was the truth. Asking a layman to investigate a specialized subject wasn't a good way to learn things. "Find out what you can," I said. "The main thing I want to know is how much it'd take to get the ship ready to lift. And say, is Lal still around?"
"I can ask," Abram said. "He was in a spacer's hostel because he doesn't have family in Salam."
"I'd like to see him," I said. Abram? Would it be possible for me to get a pistol here? I don't want one right now, but could I?"
"I guess," said Abram. He looked like I told him to smother his pet dog. "It'll cost you something, but I guess you don't care about that."
"No, I don't," I said calmly. Abram sounded bitter. I could imagine several reasons, but frankly, they didn't matter. I wasn't behaving the way he wanted me to, and he wasn't willing to accept that it was none of his business.
"Hey, boss," he said, looking up suddenly. "How many men does it take to crew a spaceship?"
"It depends," I said, "but half a dozen would be an ordinary short crew for a civilian ship. The one I was captured on had a crew of five."
"Well, I'll see if I can turn up Lal," Abrams said, since that's what you want. When I didn't walk with him toward the alley mouth, he stopped and said, You're not coming?
Not just yet, I said.
You're a bloody fool, he said and went off.
I opened the alley door and slipped into the passage. I'd seen Monica through the garden camera when Abram called me down to meet Platt's servants. I'd stuck the screwdriver in my pocket then. I removed the upper screw. I'd only put one back of the three I'd taken off originally, and the cover plate rotated clear. The sound was part squeal, part scrape.
Oh, thank the heavens, Monica said, jolted alert in her chair.
She was facing the opening when I peered through.
Where have you been?
Working to get you free, mistress, I said, polite, but feeling a little miffed. It seemed to me obvious that this was a major job, and that I had better things to do than chat with her. I'd really been looking forward to chatting with her again. And now I was doing that, and she was snarling at me.
Look, I've just spent 3,200 piastres toward getting you free, I said. I don't care about the money, but that ought to show you that it's taking a lot of effort to get there. It's going to take a good deal more time, too. If I try to cut corners, I'm going to get caught. Then you'll be here until you rot, and I'll be screaming my lungs out as they slide me down on a stake, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry, the girl said. I can make up the money to you if we just get to a civilized planet. I'm just...
Oh, it's awful, and I'm losing my mind.
If you throw a hissy now, you're going to get noticed, I said, as calm as I could. Her nervousness was getting me wound up. Just keep calm and we'll get out of here. It'll just take a while.
All right, she said, her face lowered. She looked up again. I'll be all right now. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted you to know that things are moving, even if you don't see anything for a while, I said.
Look. I take your word that Platt isn't going to do his job, but I think he'd do pretty much anything for money. I'd really like to approach him with that in mind.
Monica looked straight at my grating, but didn't speak for a moment. Then she said, quietly but very distinctly,
Platt raped me when I was brought here. He and the Admiral together. That's why I'm sure that Platt will do anything to stop me from getting back to my father.
I swallowed. Yes, I see, I said. Before I could figure out what to say next, Monica said,
You've been watching me on the cameras, haven't you?
I've watched you, yes, I said. That was obvious, after all. I'm sorry, I'll stop doing it. She sounded calm. I hope I did, too, she said.
Tell me about yourself. I can't see anything of you.
Since there were no lights in the passage, she wouldn't have been able to see my face, even if the grating hadn't been there. I said, I'm a slave. I'm 20. I swallowed again and said, My name's Roylan Olfetri, and I'm from Cinnabar. The Chamberlain bought me to run the palace computer. There was no point in hiding my name when she could find out who I was easy enough from what I'd told her already. Things could go wrong, but I no longer imagined that she might blurt my name by accident. I'm going back upstairs now, I said. There's other ways to get us off planet, but I've got a lot of work to do. Monica nodded. She said,
Thank you, Roy. And I'd like you to continue watching my room. It's the only way I can let you know if an emergency occurs.
She looked like a queen. I said, All right, and raised the cover plate again. I spent the next several hours investigating the Karst computer. With the exception of Ajax and Madame Platt's maid, all the personnel were locals. Their vehicle was a six-place ground car manufactured on Plaisance 20 years ago. I learned that from the parts orders. Parts were a huge problem. The chauffeur seemed to be the mechanic also. He regularly put in reimbursement requests for locally made alternatives to the Plaisance originals. There was almost nothing about the Alfraz, however. It could be that there was a computer sector I couldn't find, or even a separate computer dealing with the ship. More likely, the Alfraz was simply rusting somewhere in the harbor. When I originally thought of bribing Platt to get me and Monica off planet, I thought it would be expensive. But that was all right. I could make a one-time theft of at least 20,000 piastres. The amounts I was getting at present could never be discovered with the palace records in such a jumble. Nothing recorded was actually going into my pocket, and an inventory of purchased goods would be wildly off, as much through incompetence as embezzlement and sales by divisional officers. Nobody but the suppliers knew that I was getting a small rake-off, and they had no reason to complain.
A big chunk would mean writing a series of large false invoices, which associates of Abram would present. Even here, that wouldn't go unnoticed. But I hadn't worried about anybody uncovering the theft in anything less than a month. By that time, I'd be off planet, or I'd have worse problems than being uncovered as a thief. Platt was running so close to the edge, however, that I'm pretty sure I could have bought him for less than I'd paid his employees to betray him. Platt couldn't be any part of the escape plan now, though, or at any rate, he couldn't be aware of the part he'd be playing. Abram's reappearance startled me, as it always did when I was concentrating. Which, come to think of it, was most of the time I was alone.
"A good time for a break at Etzel's?" he said.
I shut down the console.
"A really good time," I said.
We walked down to the seafront in silence as usual. I think it would have been safe to talk. We weren't going to say anything that two or three words would have gotten us attention, and nobody would hear more as we passed them. But Abram was busy watching our surroundings and neighbors as though he expected an ambush. There were certainly places in Salaam that a stranger shouldn't enter, especially after dark, but broad daylight on the central boulevard wasn't one of them. Still, if it made Abram more comfortable to do it his way, that didn't hurt me. We got a table as usual.
"Lal's going to meet us here soonest," Abram said.
He grimaced and added,
"Say that other thing we were talking about, you still want it?"
I nodded.
"You have it?"
"I can get it," he said, "but it's 300p. I drew the money out of my belt. I didn't know what I might need a pistol for, and I hoped I wouldn't need one at all. I certainly wouldn't need 300 Ben Yusuf piastres if I got off planet. Lal joined us as Abram wrapped the money into his tight-wound turban. The boy set wine around and left. I said, "What can you tell me about the Afraz?"
"Me, nothing. So I looked up Lal," Abram said. "I'm a slave, and none of the boatmen will take me out to a ship. They lose both hands if they help a slave escape."
Lal looked at the glass of wine with a sour expression.
"Abram got me a bottle to carry out with me," he said. "That was the ticket with the watchman, Ahmed. But I had to drink with him."
He shook his head. "It's awful stuff, just awful," he said. "I'd give a lot for a drink of fresh palm sap from Kashgar. But it has to be fresh, or it'd be worse than this." He tapped the glass.
"What about the Afraz?" I said.
I didn't disagree about the wine in places like Etzel's, but it didn't matter. Lal shrugged.
2,000 tons, he said. "One antenna ring. In bad shape on the outside, worse on the inside."
He grinned at me.
"About the same as the Martinique. Maybe even a little worse. There's electric cables running over the cabin floor, I guess because the console's been rewired."
"Can it lift?" I said.
"I guess," Lal said. "Platt put a watchman aboard, so I guess he thought so at least." I didn't touch the console, let alone light the thrusters.
"How did you get aboard with the watchman?" Abram said.
"Just trying to figure it out in case I need to do something like that myself."
"I told Ahmed I'd been a crewman on the ship who just wanted another look for old times," Lal said, grinning. "But mostly I waved the bottle when I'd banged on the float, so he stuck his head out the hatch. That did the talking for me."
"Is Ahmed a spacer?" I said.
"I don't think so," Lal said. "Also, from the way he talked, he'd been a doorkeeper before Platt hired him to live on board the ship. He's got a little skiff to paddle himself to shore for supplies."
Lal grinned again.
"From the way Ahmed talked," he said, "he hasn't been paid in near 6 months. He sold everything loose in the cabin for his upkeep, and if he knows about the outside tool hawkers, he's cleaned them out too."
I took a deep breath and asked the big question. "How large a crew would the Afraz need?" I said. "Could we work her with two? That's you and me?"
Lal's expression was a lot like the one Abram got when I insisted on interfering in the wives' wing.
"It'll be slow," he said. "You know the rig isn't going to work worth a damn, and that means recalculating every course. We'll be hopping all over the cosmos to get where we're trying to go."
I nodded. "I agree," I said. "I think I can plot us a better course than the console alone can. But that's not going to help the ship hold that course if the rig won't go into place."
"I guess we could do it," Lal said.
He gave me his grin again, this time with a very sad tinge.
"You saved my life, Roy. There's ways I'd rather spend it than dicking around the Matrix in a tramp spaceship, but that's still better than floating the rest of my life in a crap air suit."
"Deal," I said, offering him my hand. We shook.
"If you're not going to drink this," said Abram, picking up Lal's untouched wine. I guess I am.
He tossed it down.
Abram and I spent the afternoon on our rounds with the suppliers. Not only would an influx of cash feel good, I wasn't short, but there'd been enough outgo to make me uneasy. But it was important not to change my regular behavior now. Anything that made people wonder about me was dangerous, because they might start looking more closely. By now, the supplier smiled when we came in. Balian even took me into his office while his nephews drank with Abram.
You know, Roy, Balian said as he poured the wine, I was worried when you showed up. The palace, they think they can squeeze and squeeze, and little businessmen like me, we've got to pay. But if they squeeze too hard, they'll kill us. They wouldn't like that, and I really wouldn't like it.
There's plenty to go around, I said between sips, if everybody's reasonable.
I appreciate how you took care of Mahmed when he got drafted, Balian said.
One of Bashir's sergeants had decided to go into business for himself, I said. I explained to Bashir that if Mahmed, one of the nephews in the front of the shop, wasn't released from conscription immediately, the admiral was going to muster the entire army as listed on the pay records. It turned out that wasn't something Bashir wanted to have happen.
Bashir collected the pay of nearly twice as many soldiers as were actually in the palace. That was in addition to what he stole on equipment.
Could you have done that? Balian said.
I shrugged. Bashir thought I could, I said. I'd never want to swear to what the admiral was going to do.
Balian began to laugh.
Myself, I would not bet against you, Roy, he said. It is much better to be your friend.
We chatted a little longer. Then I left with Abram on the way to the next vendor on my list. The nephews had put the week's payment into the satchel over Abram's shoulder. Its thin fabric was woven from the roots of a local plant and would turn a knife slash. I thought of what my disappearance would mean for Balian and the other suppliers. They didn't all like me. Ali, son of Ali, the main local wine supplier, didn't like anyone, as best I could tell. But they were all better off for my presence in the equation, and I think they'd all admit it. Their lives were going to get worse when I was gone, whether that meant off-planet or dead. I liked them, mostly. Even Ali, son of Ali, kept his word. To me, that is. His invoices to the palace were as false as everybody else's. I would feel sorry for people who were harmed by my leaving, but my duty lay elsewhere. To the Republic of Cinnabar, to Captain Leary, who'd given me a chance when nobody else had been willing to. And just maybe to Roylan Olfetri, a kid who'd never consciously done anybody harm. Our way out of the market took us to a coffee bar at the intersection of the aisle we were following with the cross aisle. I gestured to it and said, I want some coffee, and I want to talk. My drink at home was beer, or the bitter chocolate beverage that was more popular on Alliance Worlds than in Cinnabar space, but I thought the coffee might clear my head. Balian hadn't been the only supplier who'd chosen to be hospitable while paying over my commission. We moved cushions to an open space, and the proprietor brought a little three-legged table to set beside us. The coffee came in tiny glasses. You had to drink it carefully, or you'd choke on the grounds that half-filled each container. So, I said to Abram, the racket in the covered market hid our words from anybody who wasn't seated with us. Are you coming with me?
I don't know anything about spaceships, Abram said sullenly.
He wasn't meeting my eyes. I didn't ask if you'd join the crew, I said. Frankly, I don't have time to train you, so you'd be more trouble than you were worth, but... I carefully tasted my coffee. This wasn't going to change my opinion of the beverage. Though there won't be anything for me linking you to what's going to happen. I don't have to tell you that if I'm not around to talk to, they'll be talking to the folks who knew me best. I smiled because I'd thought of something funny. I said, you know, Georgius is going to be lucky if he just loses his job. Well, he chose his side when he bought me.
I got family in the Kabylia, Abram muttered. They don't like me much, but if somebody from the city comes out to the farm, they'll be lucky to get farther than the bottom of the cesspool.
You'll have plenty of warning, I said, taking another taste. But I wanted you to know that you've got a choice.
I came here from the farm, Abram said. His hands began to shake and he put his cup down. I never been anywhere else, not even Eski Marrakesh.
He swallowed.
Look, he said to his cup on the table. I've talked to spacers plenty. I'm not yellow, I'll fight anybody, I will. But it scares me, all that nothing. It scares me, and I'm sorry, but it does.
Abram's eyes were tight shut, but tears were leaking out of them.
I put down my coffee and leaned forward to hold his shoulders. "Hey, buddy," I said. "No sweat. Look, I've been in space myself and I don't disagree with you." I held Abram until his body stopped shaking. When I released him, he blew his nose violently on his sleeve and looked up at me. "The thing is," I said, "you know the things I've been doing? How much longer do you think I'm going to get away with it?" "Yeah," Abram said. "Well, let's get your ass off planet before you wind up with a stake up it, hey?" When we got back to the palace, I found the Admiral at the console again. I swallowed and went down to the main courtyard, where I played a game of checkers with one of the regulars there. I desperately wanted to get off Ben Yusuf, but my stomach turned every time I thought of the Admiral and Monica. I wanted her out of this place even more than I wanted to be out myself. Chapter 24. When I was sure that the Admiral had gone back to the wives' wing, I checked the cameras myself. Monica was in the garden. I thought twice about what I was going to do next, but I really wanted to talk to her. I headed down for the alley door. Abram had gone off on business without telling me what that was. He carried the satchel. We transferred the takings from it to my money belt. I brought a heavy broom, as I'd taken to doing. At Marshall's at lunch one day, a yard man who'd seen me leaving the palace with it asked what the broom was for. I told him Georgios had told me to sweep the alley. I guessed because the Admiral had said something. Did he want me to tell Georgios that the yard man was wondering about what was going on? The yard man didn't, and that ended the discussion for good. I thought of Georgios as a pompous joke, but he frightened people on the bottom rung of the palace. He made a point of bullying those whom he could, and the fact he reported directly to the Admiral gave him a certain amount of real authority. Mind, what I'd told Balian was true. You could never count on the direction the Admiral's whim was going to take him. I couldn't think of any situation in which I didn't believe I'd be better off going unnoticed than I would be for enlisting the Admiral's help. I walked into the alley whistling. There were two men farther down. I began to sweep enthusiastically, keeping my eyes on the job. The men moved off in the other direction. There was nothing they could do about my plans, but I didn't want spectators. I pulled the door open and slipped inside. It was getting easier to swing the door every time I used it. The electronic locks remained in place until the moment I was ready to leave the console. It was likely enough that somebody passing through the alley would tug at the handle in a vague hope of finding something to steal inside. I walked quickly to the inner end of the passage. I realized that I'd better have a light with me when I fetched Monica. Somebody who didn't trust that the tunnel was clear wasn't likely to stride along in the dark at the speed I wanted us to be showing then. I'd picked up a fist-sized lamp from Bryce that glowed when I twisted the top. Balian hadn't been sure how long it would stay lit, but the two of us, plus Abram and the nephews, couldn't find any way to change batteries. I might get a nasty surprise, but it was still a better choice than bringing along an oil lamp. I opened the grating cover. "Thank heaven," Monica said. "Thank heaven." "Things are moving along," I said. "I think it may be very soon." "Can't be too soon," she said fiercely. "I think I'm going to go mad if I have to stay one more day." I grimaced, an expression which she couldn't see. "Look," I said, "this is really dangerous. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I can't check ahead of time." I tapped lightly on the grating. "Even opening this door," I said. "I've been oiling the hinges, but I don't dare risk opening it before we're really going." "Roy," Monica said, leaning forward in her seat, "you're not guaranteeing me a happy future. You're just making it possible for me to have a future that I'll want to live." I swallowed. "Yeah, well, I'll try," I said. Monica, could you be ready to go tonight? To be out at this door at 11:30? "Yes," she said. "Can we go then?" I considered the possibilities. I didn't see any reason not to do it immediately, though it scared the crap out of me. "We'll go tonight unless something comes up, and then I'll try to tell you," I said. There wasn't any way to tell her anything except by coming to the grate. What if something happened to me? Maybe Abram would be willing to take a message. "Look, I'll go off now," I said. "There's stuff I need to set up, but we'll try tonight." I closed the grate, running through the number of people I had to see immediately. I grinned. If I waited another month, it'd still scare the crap out of me. This way, I didn't have as long to worry. I knew the day Monica had entered the wives' wing.
Through that date, I'd found the Admiral's first approach to Platt. I crafted my own echo to it. Most excellent colleague and friend, I have been fortunate in finding another quantity of fine Saguntine vintage, equal and perhaps superior in quality to that which we shared 6 months ago. This has a beauty which blazes like the very sun, and I am convinced it has never been uncorked. If at midnight tonight you will appear at the alley entrance as before, a trusted servant will conduct you to where I wait with the vintage. We will throw dice, you and I, for the privilege of the first sip from the bottle. Then, man and man, we will take turns throughout the night. Yours in truest fellowship, Mustafa Reyes. I sent the message off, then leaned back and let out my breath. I must have closed my eyes. Abram jolted me alert by saying, "Did you just bloody die?" I jumped upright. He was standing beside me, looking disgusted and angry. The satchel was over his shoulder. He glanced down at it and said, "I got something for you." "Let's go down to Marshall's," I said. It struck me that there were a lot of people on Salaam whom I was going to miss, which I never would have believed when I arrived here. Marshall's was busy. Abram and I picked up pasties and wine and carried them farther up the side of the palace to where we were alone. We squatted with our backs leaned against the stone. I wasn't in the mood to eat, but I needed to get something in my stomach. The next few hours were just going to make me more nervous. Abram set the satchel between us. He took a deep draught of his wine and said, "This is yours." I set my glass down on the other side to free a hand, then, with one finger, lifted the length of finely woven goat's wool to see the pistol beneath it. It was standard Alliance military issue and looked brand new. There was a loading tube in place, though I didn't know how many rounds were in it. I wasn't going to take the weapon out and look it over until I knew I was alone, probably tonight in the passage. But for now, it looked like a very functional pistol. "Thank you," I said. I took a bite of pasty, then opened a pocket of my money belt. "I've got some money for you."
"What's that for?"
Abram said. He covered the coins with his hand as I opened a second pocket. "For your family," I said, handing over more coins. "This is a good time to visit them. I mean, right now." I opened a third pocket and emptied it also. I'd still have 35 Alliance Thalers and 40 Karst Sequins, both of which could be negotiated on most planets of the region. I didn't dare to collect more off-world currency for fear of raising questions, but I'd happily accepted it in place of piastres when a supplier had offered it.
"Look," Abram said angrily, "I'm not working for you anymore. That's what you're saying, right?"
I didn't understand his tone, but I nodded as I continued to hand over all my local money.
"If you want to put it that way, yes."
"Then you don't have any right to tell me where to go," Abram said. "I'll go where I bloody well want to go, whenever I want to do it." I started to say that I hadn't been trying to give him orders, but he knew that. I nodded and took another bite of my pasty. It was extremely good. Abram crammed the rest of his into his mouth, chewed and swallowed. Then, still around a normal mouthful, said, "I'm going to get another glass of wine, and then I've got business to tend to." He stood and added, "Business of my own." "I hope it goes well," I said to his back as he stalked off. I thought of taking a nap. I had a little room off Georgios's entry hall. I didn't bother because I couldn't have slept, much as I knew I'd need it later. Besides, somebody likely would have come in and waked me up for some favor or other if I'd tried to sleep in the daytime. If Abram had been here, he'd have guarded the door curtain. I hoped that, despite his bravado about not getting out of Salaam, he'd had sense enough to leave at least until people had forgotten about me. I didn't doubt his courage, but he had a good mind, too. When he cooled off, he could see that him staying around to be caught wouldn't help anybody. An hour before midnight, I hung the satchel over my right shoulder, picked up my broom, and made my way down to the front entrance. There were a lot of folks in the plaza, chatting with friends and passing bottles around. At least two people within earshot were playing stringed instruments and singing. They were different songs, and at least the nearer singer was so drunk that he was repeating the same line, "We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile." I could hear people in the alley as I reached it from the side street. I was having to deal with something I hadn't thought of, even sooner than I'd thought I would. Mind, this was something I should have thought of. One choice was simply to ignore the people whispering and to go past them to the door.
Instead, I reached into the satchel and brought out the lamp in my left hand. Holding it up and out, I loudly said, "Hoy, what are you playing at?" The light worked fine. It wasn't bright, but in the close darkness it was as good as a spotlight. I saw three forms, all men as best I could tell in the swirl of loose garments, as they ran the other way down the alley. That wasn't the only thing that could have happened, but my right hand was inside the hanging satchel. I hadn't had to test the pistol also, thank heavens. I entered the passage and closed the door after me. I was breathing hard. I set down the satchel. It was heavy enough to unbalance me with the weight of both the pistol and the pry bar. I hoped I wouldn't have to use either one, but who knew? The light was still on. I started to turn it off to conserve power, then worried that I wouldn't be able to turn it back on. Finally, I left it on just for the company the light would give me for the next 20 minutes. It shot the hand bolt on the alley door. There was one on the garden door also, but I left it. I wasn't worried about somebody trying to enter from the wives' wing. At 11:27 p.m., I dropped the cover plate. Through the grating, I heard a woman say, "What's that light?" The voice wasn't Monica's. I'd forgotten that at night, any light in the passage would be visible in the garden. I heard a thunk. "Quick," Monica said, "open the door." I pulled it open. The hinges were stiff, but the oil had done its job. My blood was jumping with so much adrenaline that I felt like I could have ripped the door off, let alone opening it. Azul lay in front of the doorway. Monica was bending over her. She dropped the unlit brass lamp that she seemed to have used as a club. She removed a glittery barrette from the fallen woman's hair. "Get her inside," Monica said. Then she said, almost the same breath, "Oh, thank the heavens you're here." I dragged Azul into the passage. Her head was bleeding. That must have been a hell of a clout. As soon as Azul's feet were out of the way, Monica tried to close the door. It was far too heavy for her. I reached past her and shoved it shut, then shot the interior bolt. I bent at the waist so that I could suck in more air. All my muscles were wobbling. I pointed a finger at Azul and said, "What was she doing here?" Monica settled the barrette in her own hair and straightened. I told her that I'd found something that frightened me, and I needed her to take it to the Admiral, she said. "We slipped out secretly." "But why?" I said. "She saw this in my hair the first day I arrived," Monica said, touching the barrette, "and took it. I think just because I had it, not that she particularly wanted it. And she kept wearing it so that I'd see it every day. Look, she's a nasty person. Or anyway, she used to be a nasty person. Her breathing was loud and very slow. But she might not have come alone." "She did, though," Monica said, drawing herself up straight. "And I wasn't going to let the bitch rob me. I'd have bought you 10 baubles just as nice as that when the first time we got to a civilized planet," I thought. The trick was that we had to get off Ben Yusuf first. Complaining would be as pointless as what Monica had done. "Come on," I said aloud. "Our ride is going to be here at any time now." We left Azul snoring on the ground and walked briskly to the alley end of the passage. I said, "I'm going to switch off the light now," and did so. The sudden darkness helped me relax. Monica was wearing loose trousers and tunic, all the clothing any of the wives had. It wasn't ideal for anything but the wives' wing, but she wouldn't have had a choice. "Why did you turn the light out?" she asked. "I'm waiting for somebody to come with a car," I said. "I don't want him to get a good view of us until I'm ready for him to." She didn't respond. There was nothing to say, but I still expected her to say something. Monica was a real person, not an image in a camera, and I was starting to get a view of what was below that surface. Someone knocked at the alley door. I was expecting that, but I still jumped nearly out of my skin. They were using their knuckles, not something hard. I slid back the bolt. There wasn't a view slit on this door, so I had to assume that Platt had arrived. Idlers in the alley might have tried the door, but they wouldn't have knocked. I shoved it open and whispered, "Come in, quick." Somebody squeezed through the crack in the door. "Can we have a light?" the man said. I pulled the door shut behind him. I got the pistol out of my cargo pocket, then turned the light on. "Master Platt," I said, quietly but not whispering any longer, "you're to do exactly what I tell you. If you don't, I'll shoot you dead. Do you understand?" Platt's throat worked as he swallowed. His eyes were wide and his mouth fell open. "Do you understand?" I repeated. "I do," he said. Then he said, "Who are you?" "A distressed spacer whom you're going to help get off planet," I said. That was more or less his job, after all. "Do you have a gun?"
No, he said. No, he swallowed again and added, my driver has a gun.
Then I'd like you to go to the door and call him in here, I said. I was impressed at how calm I sounded.
Monica, keep hold of the back of his tunic, but try not to be seen. If he makes a break, I'll have to kill him, and I don't want to do that.
Platt hesitated. The door was closed, after all. I smiled at him, keeping the pistol aimed at his belly, but my bent arm withdrawn a little. I didn't want him to grab for it.
Just call him calmly, I said.
He needs to give me his gun, but nobody's going to be hurt if he does. I pushed the door open enough that Platt could put his head out.
Hiram, he said.
There was a squeakiness to his voice, but I didn't suppose he could help that.
Come in with me.
The driver replied something, but I couldn't make out the words. Platt was wearing a loose brown tunic, a local garment. Monica had gathered a double fistful of the material into her hands, but she was bending down to stay hidden by the door panel.
Platt snarled. Just leave the bloody car, leave it!
I heard the car door open and thunk shut. I could drive, but the alley was so narrow that getting down it with enough room to open a door was an expert job. If I'd backed out, I'd have had to navigate by the sound of fenders rubbing.
Sir, said a voice outside.
I pushed the door farther open, straining not to seem to be straining. I said, come on in, just stay calm and everything's going to be fine.
What?
The driver said. He was about 40 and sturdy looking, but his face was unmarked. I didn't have the impression of a brawler.
Platt, back up, I said, let Hiram come in.
The consul jerked backward with a squawk. Monica was a strong lady and a very determined one.
Come in, Hiram, I repeated, and put your hands on the wall while I take your gun.
The driver squeezed through the opening, moving as far to the right as he could. My pistol was aimed at his left eye.
He whispered, don't shoot me.
Just lean on the wall, I said, I'm not going to hurt you. The driver was wearing a blue jacket, maybe from a uniform of some sort, but his pistol was loose in the side pocket instead of being holstered. I withdrew it and dropped it into my left cargo pocket. Stepping back but keeping my eyes on our two prisoners, I said, now we're going back into the car, and Hiram will drive to the harbor. Monica, take the pistol I just put in my pocket and go out first. Walk to the ride so that you're not in the way if one of them does something dumb.
Where are we going? Platt said.
He kept swallowing, and his voice was ragged. I felt Monica take the gun and slip out behind me. When she'd reached the alley, I said, we're just going to the harbor, like I said. I'll leave the two of you there. You've got nothing to worry about.
I'm ready, Monica called.
You next, Hiram, I said. Don't get into the car until the rest of us are out, though. But no problems, okay? I'm a very good shot. I wasn't, not with a pistol anyway. I hoped I wouldn't need to prove that. The driver left the passage, then Platt himself when I nodded to him. I followed them, still holding the light. I left the door open. Azul had been a thorough bitch from everything I'd seen through the cameras, and particularly a bitch to the blonde young Monica. I still didn't want to leave her to die in a dark tunnel. If it was open at the alley end, somebody was going to venture in soon. They might even do something for the injured woman. Monica held her pistol concealed under a fold of her loose sleeve. It was aimed at the driver.
Do I get in, or are you leaving me? Platt said.
Hiram, open the trunk, I said. Get in the trunk, Master Platt. You're going along, but I don't need you until you tell your watchman that it's all right for us to come aboard.
You can't do that, Platt said.
The driver leaned through his open window and touched a control. The trunk lid popped open. Get in, I said, or I'll leave you here in the tunnel, dead. And I'll figure to bribe the watchman. Your choice. Platt climbed carefully into the trunk. He was trying to find a comfortable spot to lie down when Monica slammed the lid onto him. He shouted angrily, but when she slammed it again, he'd flattened out of the way. Monica, get in back, I said. Keep your gun on Hiram as he gets in, and then I'll go around to the other side and get in beside him. When she was inside with her pistol touching the back of the driver's neck, I walked around to the passenger door and got in beside him. I just drive down to the harbor and park where the boats have pulled up on shore, I said. No need for a hurry. As soon as we're gone, you and your boss can go do anything you please. The driver was as rigid as a statue behind the steering yoke, but he drove precisely. He didn't look over at me or the pistol in my lap. We drove to the end of the alley without touching a wall. A step encroached from the left near the far end, but we rocked over it without difficulty. The driver fed in just enough power to get us up and then down with minimum disruption.
We turned left at the street and continued toward the water at the same sedate pace as we'd navigated the alley. The pavement was wide enough, but there were scores of idlers out on the hot night. They moved out of the way, but occasionally somebody shouted an insult. Monica slid across the back seat and put her lips close to my right ear, the one away from the driver.
"This pistol," she whispered. "It isn't loaded. The tube fell out."
"All right," I said. I suspected that the driver hadn't known that the pistol he carried was empty. Certainly he'd acted as though Monica was holding a loaded gun. It wasn't exactly a complication, since I hadn't planned on getting a second pistol from our prisoners. I'd thought we might, though. We drove toward the harbor, rocking on the irregular pavers. We reached the parking area where Georgios had brought me. The sand beyond that point was too soft for normal tires. There were no other vehicles, but some of the watermen's huts were lighted by small fires or lamps, like the one I'd used in the passage. "Now, Hiram," I said, "we're all going to get out. And you're going to reach in through the window again and open the trunk so that the consul can join us." Monica continued to point her pistol at the driver from under the fabric so that he couldn't see that there wasn't a loading tube. I wondered if it had fallen out unnoticed in his pocket when he'd bumped something, or if he simply hadn't realized it was missing to begin with. The amount of technical ignorance on Ben Youssef went beyond making me a wizard for being able to give a computer basic commands. The trunk popped open. "Out," I said. Platt carefully straightened, then clambered out as quickly as he could. I guess he was afraid that Monica would slam the lid on him again. We were far enough from the huts that the watermen couldn't be sure of what was going on at the car. "Now," I said to him, "we're going over to the shelters and find a boatman to take us to the Alfraz. She's your ship, so there shouldn't be any..." "Roy," Monica said, not loud but urgently. I broke off and followed her eyes. Somebody was coming toward us from the huts. The trunk lid was still up. I shifted to the side so that I was sure the newcomer couldn't see my pistol.
"Hey, boss," Abram called. "I figured you'd come here looking for a boat, but I didn't realize you were coming in style. That's the Karst Consul's car, isn't it?"
"Yes, and this is the Karst Consul," I said. "You might want to go somewhere else, stranger."
"I'll take my chances," Abram said, nonchalant as always. "Anyway, I already got a boat laid on for you. Come on down to the freight landing."
"Hang on," I said, and did some quick figuring. "Hiram, you get into the trunk now. I still need your boss to board the Alfraz, but I don't want to have to watch you, too."
The driver bowed and said, "Yes, Lord."
He got into the trunk quickly and made himself as low as he could. Monica closed the lid over him. I nodded to Abram. "We're ready," I said. A cargo lighter of some size was drawn up at the landing stage. I heard a thrum rather than the sound of a reciprocating engine. It was probably the flywheel of some sort of electrical drive. The water alongside the hull quivered in the starlight. A mound of supplies filled the central portion of the vessel. Abram hopped on.
"You next, Consul," I said.
I was holding the pistol close to my chest. It was possible that the two boatmen in the stern couldn't see it in this light, but they could probably guess that something off-kilter was going on. I trusted Abram to fix any problems that this caused. I was out of my depth. We boarded. Abram cast off the line looped around a concrete bollard. Without verbal commands, the lighter backed into the bay, coasted for a moment with the drive grunting, and then proceeded forward in a curve that took us to the ship moored 500 feet offshore. Even in the darkness, I could see that the hull was bigger than those of the pirate cutters that made up most of the port's traffic. The boatman cut the drive when we were 50 feet short of the nearer outrigger on a parallel line. We closed on momentum. And the boatman switched to reverse. Our bow dipped, but only momentarily. The lighter's side swung against the outrigger with a clang that could have waked the dead, but our speed was so slight that we didn't even rebound. Abram hopped onto the outrigger and looped the hawser around one of the struts. When he tossed the free end back, I hitched it to a cleat on the lighter's side. The small hatch into the cabin started to open. I turned to Platt and said, "Stand up, you're on now. Tell him we're boarding for an inspection." The consul stood up shakily.
"Ahmed, it's your master," he called. "We're coming aboard."
Lal stood in the hatchway.
"Welcome, Captain Roy," he said. "I've just been having a drink with my friend Ahmed. Do you want to board by the way of the strut, or should I lower the main hatch?"
"We've got a load of stores," Abram said. "Lower the hatch, and you can come help us get it aboard, too."
The cabin hatch was an airlock and not ordinarily used while a ship was on a planet. A spacer could easily mount the forward strut, which attached the outrigger to the hull. The struts were extended now, but would draw in close when the ship reached orbit. When fully lowered, the main hatch became a ramp resting on the port outrigger and giving general access to the ship. I wasn't sure Monica could board by the strut, so I'd have asked